The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this Friday, and that means you're now listening to Literature on WRUU LP 107.5 FM. I'm your host, Lee Rich, and as many of you already know, here at Listening to Literature, we like to examine thought-provoking books of the present and the past and offer listeners book news, reviews, and interviews. And you can find additional information about Listening to Literature and the books and authors that we feature here at WRUU.org or listeningtoliterature.com. And as always, you are welcome to contact me anytime with book suggestions or other comments at listeningtoliterature.com. So today on Listening to Literature, we are talking with Savannah author Judy Fogarty about her debut novel, Breaking and Holding. Judy Fogarty earned a master's degree in vocal performance from the University of Illinois, and she has enjoyed a long career as a marketer of private golf communities, including the Landings on Skidaway Island. Now, her debut novel, Breaking and Holding, was published in 2016, and she has just completed her second novel, and that novel is titled Moon. Judy is a native Savannian. She lives, writes, reads, and runs on the Isle of Hope and is a devoted and even rowdy tennis fan. Now, her novel, Breaking and Holding, begins in the summer of 1978, and most of the novel takes place on an island near Charleston. It tells the story of two women, young housewife Patricia Colon and single and career-driven Lynn Hewitt, who are connected through Patricia's husband, Jack. The novel speaks to fundamental issues such as love, friendship, relationships, finding one's own voice, and, of course, tennis. So, Judy, thank you for joining Listening to Literature today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. So let's jump in and start talking about your first novel, Breaking and Holding. Now, this book is set in the late 1970s. It does go into the early 1980s. Right. Why this time period?
Well, I actually began the novel in around 1979.
Okay.
So it's always fun when people say, well, how long did it take you to write it? And I say, oh, about 40 years.
that gives me some hope, though.
But actually, it spent most of those years in my attic after I had written one draft and tried to get it published without success and, you know, gave up. And then on a lark, I just took it down one day and read it again and thought it was absolutely terribly young. Okay. And not very good at all. But every now and then I'd hit a part that would just, I just go, ooh, that's really good. So I decided to try it again and I thought I would tweak it and be ready to go in a couple of weeks. Well, the novel took on big changes, and it took many years before it was transformed into Breaking and Holding as it is today.
And what it is today. Yeah. So when you put it away in that attic, how long was it until you took it back out and started thinking, I'm going to play around with this again?
It probably was, say, 1982 when it went into the attic, and I took it out again probably around 2008.
Okay, okay.
And when I took it out and decided to rewrite it, my first thought was, well, I'm going to pick up this story and drop it into the present day. That'll be a lot easier. But what I quickly discovered was that wasn't going to work at all. And there were a couple of reasons for that. One was technology. If we had in 1978 the technology that we have today, there's no way the story could have happened the way it did. Google and text messages would have dramatically changed the plot.
Yes.
So that wouldn't work. And with my characters, to be believable, they needed to have sort of the attitude that people had in the 1970s. That was known as the me decade.
Yes.
So it was a time of narcissistic navel-gazing and really putting me first, and if it feels good, do it. And I kind of needed those things to make their actions believable. Right. And as I continued to think about it, and I shared it with my daughter, and I realized how differently she sees things and how certain things that she didn't really understand about how things were for women. Yes. In that time. So it became important to me to help her see that, to help women of her generation see the differences. And also, I thought it would be a fun look back for women of my age and my generation. So looking back to the 70s and early 80s became kind of fun. And also just the disillusionment of that time following Vietnam and Watergate, those also were critical to the story.
Right. And you really weave in that social and political history, but not in sort of a, you know, beating it over the reader's head kind of way. But there are little nods in there, both to feminist novels and changes in feminism, mm-hmm. Some of those political changes. You also talk about the Pope dying during that time period.
Right.
As well as the birth of Louise Brown.
Right. And I basically just read a lot about the time period and then chose events that figured into the story and would different characters would relate to. And the fashion and the music That's and right. the literature of the time. It was all very fun to go back and remember some of those things.
Absolutely. And you weave references to literature all throughout Breaking and Holding. And maybe when we talk about one of your main characters, we can talk about that. Before we jump into the characters, tell us a little bit about the setting. Where is Breaking and Holding primarily set? And why did you choose this location?
It's primarily set on Kiowa Island near Charleston, and that grew out of my experience as a marketer of private communities like The Landings, and the fact that two of the characters are actually in advertising and doing the same kind of marketing work that I did. So I thought very hard about using Savannah with The Landings community, which I knew very well, but I needed a beach. I needed the characters to live in a beach house. And of course, that's the one thing that is farther away from The Landings than it is on Kiowa Island. So I ended up choosing Kiowa and Charleston, which of course are a lot like The Landings.
Absolutely.
And Savannah.
Had you spent any time on Kiowa before you started writing this?
A bit, not a lot, but I primarily knew it as a competitor for The Landings.
Okay.
So when I was marketing The Landings, that of course was important. So we would visit and take note, and that was basically my experience. Plus, I was a big fan in those days of the Spoleto Festival and went every year. So I knew Charleston and loved Charleston from that experience. Of course, now we have our own music festival,
that's
Savannah
right.
Music Festival. And so that's taken the place, at least in my heart, as a music festival I want to take part in and attend every year.
So you can also see how Savannah has changed from the time period of the 70s and 80s until now.
Indeed.
Just as much as you can in terms of women's rights and civil rights and the political landscape. Now, so you do have, now I know your degree's in music, but
right.
you have a lot of professional experience as a marketer.
Right.
And were you working as a marketer when you started working on the novel? Originally?
No, in 78 I was in grad school
okay.
in Illinois. But the things, it's interesting when I talk about, well, I'm a novelist with a career in marketing, but my degree is actually in vocal performance and literature. So I've tried sometimes to think, how did that happen and how can I explain that to people? And really, it's a love of language, because I do love music, but I was a singer and sang art songs, and of course, those were settings of beautiful poetry. So I love the language. The text was always very important to me. And I actually got the job as a marketer with a copywriting assignment, sort of as an audition. So the part of that job that I enjoyed the most was the writing, whether it was brochures or ads. So there again was the writing. And then, of course, what I'd always really loved was writing and fiction and stories, right. and again, just a love of language. So that's how I think the three are interwoven.
And kind of come together.
Right.
And when I was reading Breaking and Holding, not only did the story grip me, but the way that you craft sentences is very lyrical. And so I can sort of see your music background also coming into play there, not just what the sentences say, but how the sentences sound.
Yes, and the other thing I would say about it is rhythm.
Yes.
That's kind of how I know the sentence is right or the paragraph is right. There is definitely a rhythm to me, And, you know, I'll change this word or that word just until it clicks. But that's real important.
Do you read your sentences out loud when you're writing and editing?
I have done that. Sometimes I do that. Okay. I pretty much can hear it in my head. And my characters have voices that I hear in my head. It plays like a movie almost.
Right.
I see them. I hear them. But again, the lyrical, the words, the love of language, and the rhythm, all that figures into my writing.
All together. Before we jump in and talk about the characters and the plot of Breaking and Holding, since we're talking about how you craft sentences as well, would you be interested in maybe reading a little bit of an excerpt from Breaking and Holding?
I would love to. I'd like to read the beginning. The novel is in multiple points of view.
Yes.
And the character who begins the story is Lynn. So this is in her voice.
And about how old is Lynn at this stage?
Lynn is mid-30s.
Okay, so she's, yeah, okay, all
right. Right. So, all right. And so here we go. This isn't my story. It's Patricia and Terry's. But in the summer of 1978, their lives were wound around mine like strands of twine around a spool. Twine, rope, barbed wire by August. I still have the notes I took out of habit that summer, not knowing what else to do. I have Patricia's journal, too, which she left at the beach house on Kiowa Island in the aftermath. Even now, 5 years later, I find it too painful to read. I have the moist heat of the Carolina coast, even here in New York. I see the rivers and smell the salt marsh, sweet with life and bitingly sour. I hear the perpetual respiration of the ocean rolling us toward what I call date certain, September 1st, 1978, the beginning of the Labor Day weekend. I have me, interloper turned housemate, a his and hers confidant, counselor, friend, speaking truth to love, lying to power. A fascinated witness in the middle of it all, the place I hate most to be.
If you're just now joining us, this is Listening to Literature on WRUU LP 107.5 FM. I'm your host, Lee Rich, and what you just heard was an excerpt out of Judy Fogarty's debut novel called Breaking and Holding. And we're here talking with Judy today about her novel and about her life as a writer. So, Judy, so that was the very opening page of Breaking and Holding. What's the story about? It's sort of almost a romantic triangle, but in the story, one of your characters is an avid reader. You mentioned Chekhov's The Seagull. I started thinking a little bit that your novel is kind of like The Seagull, or maybe even a modern Great Gatsby. How would you describe Breaking and Holding?
I would say it is indeed a story of obsessive love. And that a Gatsby-esque strain is very much there. Gatsby's my favorite novel.
Is it really? One of mine as well.
Right, always. And also, it's Patricia's favorite novel in the story, and she is very literary. And how I think the two are connected, Gatsby, of course, was set in the 1920s. So we have the 20s as a background for that. We have the 70s. In Breaking and Holding, we have the jazz age of Gatsby. We have the me decade
of
Breaking
70s.
And Holding.
That's right.
Right. Both are stories of obsessive love. Both have a triangle involved. And most importantly, both have an observer who is caught in the middle. It's Nick Carraway in Gatsby, and it's Lynn in my novel. And to me, that's really what made the novel interesting. And she's almost like a tour guide. She's right there the whole way and helps a reader understand everyone's perspective. And she cares deeply for all three of the people involved in the triangle. And really, it just becomes messier and messier with her at the center and trying to take care of them all.
Yeah, trying to take care of them all. And I think through the novel, she also has to figure out that, wait a minute, she also has to take care of herself, too.
Right.
Yeah. So let's talk about, we'll come back to Lynn. So like I said, she is sort of the centerpiece that holds this whole chaotic, obsessive love triangle together. together, or maybe quadrangle. We'll talk about, because there's another character who comes into play. Let's talk about Patricia. So Lynn is one of the main narrators, but Patricia is almost as well. Tell us a little bit about Patricia as a character.
Well, Patricia is very literary. She was working on a PhD, which she gave up to marry her husband, Jack. She suffered greatly as a child. She lost both of her parents in an automobile accident at the age of 7. And they were both professors of literature at Sarah Lawrence College. So even as a child, reading was very important to her. This was so traumatic for her that she withdrew, and reading became her refuge. She's also shy. Right. She's an introvert. And once this terrible thing happened to her, she became more so. And she even says at one point, my best friends are from fiction. And she's very, very beautiful, right, except for one flaw, which she has two mismatched eyes. She has one blue eye and one gray eye. So she has some insecurities about that as well. But she very much wants to find her voice, to break out of this person who's so easily manipulated and controlled by her husband, and to get back to that PhD and become the person she thinks she was meant to be.
Right. So she's a little bit younger. She's what, about 26?
26.
Okay. And so tell us a little bit more about her husband, Jack. When I was reading Breaking and Holding, in the opening chapter, I know that Patricia ends up finding and starting to read this novel called Fear of Flying, which maybe you can tell us a little bit more about. But Patricia's relationship with Jack and what she's struggling with also reminded me a little bit of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, which was in the early 60s, about that problem with no name. So what's her husband Jack like, and how does that contribute to what Patricia's struggling with?
Jack is a self-made man. He has a family and a childhood that he is not very proud of, so he worked his way out of that. Is a very successful advertising executive. He's a micromanager. He has a very bad temper, and is very highly regarded with the industry and very focused on success. He manages Patricia almost like he manages a client. He wants her to be a certain way, act a certain way. He wants her to be not only beautiful, but perfectly beautiful, to the extent that he insists she wear a tinted contact lens to make both eyes blue. So for a long time, Patricia tries to be the woman he wants her to be. He also wants her to be very extroverted and to help him entertain clients and just things that are not her nature. So finally, she reaches a point where she really wants to get away. But because he is controlling and she's timid, that's a very difficult thing for her to do.
Right, right. And Patricia loves literature, but she also loves the arts and the opera and all the things that, you know, she has access to in New York, which is where they're really based, even though most of the novel takes place on that island outside of Charleston. And Jack, he's not interested in any of those things.
He does not understand her at all. They are as mismatched as her eyes.
As her eyes, absolutely, right.
I think he... Someone asked me once, does she love him? Does he love her? They're just so mismatched that while they may, in their own way, they don't even know, really, they don't know who they are.
Right, right.
He has no understanding of her, and really she doesn't understand him. So it's really a good thing that they eventually will go their own ways. It's a marriage that's desolate and it's colorless in many, many ways.
Right. Now, and Lynn works for Jack.
Lynn works for Jack.
And what's the relationship like between Jack and Lynn? Does Jack get Lynn and Lynn get Jack in a way that Jack doesn't get Patricia?
They are exactly alike. They're both very career-driven. They're very smart. They're good with people. They're charming with clients. And Lynn, of course, is a woman in a man's world, trying so hard to succeed. And Jack recognizes that, and he really uses her in a way. He has an MBA from Harvard. She has an MBA from Harvard Radcliffe, which at that time, it was the same exact program, same degree program, same classes, same exams. But if you were a woman, that Radcliffe had to go on that diploma. And so she functions as his assistant. But he takes advantage of all the skills that she has, and it's kind of a game he plays with her. Almost, they're constantly battling in almost a funny way. But he irritates her on purpose sometimes, and but he thinks the world of her, and she of him.
Right. There's definitely a respect between the two of them. But like you said, he sometimes will use her in a way, like, again, to manage his wife, where he might not have done so if Lynn had been a male employee.
Exactly. As his assistant, she's often asked to step in when he is totally befuddled by Patricia, has no idea. She's a problem that he can't solve with objective strategies and plans.
Right.
And so he actually hires Lynn with that as almost part of her job description, that she's going to help out with Patricia. And Patricia and Lynn, of course, are very different, but because of that situation, they become very close and sort of learn from each other and learn to appreciate each other. And Patricia wants to be strong and assertive like Lynn, mm-hmm. and Lynn wants a deeper emotional connection to the world, more like Patricia.
Right, so they can really learn from one another. Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a genuine friendship between Patricia and Lynn?
I do. I think it would never have happened except for Jack, because probably they wouldn't have been in the same social circle ever. And even if they had met, they were so very different, I don't think they would have connected.
Right.
So the fact that he forced them to be together was definitely contributed to their friendship.
Right. So it's in one way, it's a friendship of happenstance. But now that they've been thrown into the situation, there is genuine friendship there.
Right. And another thing about Lynn, she's rather isolated. And I think many women were at that time. If you wanted a career,
right.
You often made men in the company feel threatened. And also they didn't want you to succeed to their level. You know, you were just a woman. And so she's isolated in that way. And also at the same time, in a time when women were just beginning to get into the workplace, women who were staying at home, sort of resented that as well. So she's very, very isolated and trying so hard to prove herself in this world and to prove herself capable, that people often see her as being cold and having no needs, which when she realizes people, even Jack thinks of her as having no needs,
right.
emotional needs, and that's very painful to her because she doesn't see herself that way
right.
at all.
So she's really caught in between not only Patricia and Jack, but really caught in between in the 1970s, this idea of the quote-unquote man's world versus woman's world.
Right.
Right. So both she and Patricia are struggling with a sense of isolation and loneliness.
Right.
And you had mentioned a little bit earlier that you have written Breaking and Holding from a couple of different perspectives. So some chapters we actually have a first-person perspective from Lynn, mm-hmm. and then other chapters it's third-person, but it's from focusing on Patricia and getting into Patricia's head.
Patricia and also Terry.
Yes, we haven't talked about Terry,
who she meets. And so that's multiple points of view. And you'll often read as a first novelist, don't try multiple points of view.
Right.
So this was even more complicated because I was not only writing multiple points of view, but I had one first person and two third person points of view. And I started at one point looking for other examples of that in literature.
Okay.
They are rather hard to come by. And so that was one thing that was difficult. Even to the point when you start looking for an agent, and you start writing your query letter, they tell you, name the protagonist, name what she wants, name the obstacles in her way. So if I used Patricia as the protagonist, then the agent who also wanted the first chapter opens it, and here's Lynn.
Right.
So it became very complicated, and it really did seem to me to be everyone's story, Lynn's and Patricia's and Terry's. But my writing group, who I dearly love, so smart. Amy Condon in particular kept saying, whose story is this? Whose story is this? I must have written 18 beginnings.
Really?
I tried so hard. And finally, I came out with what I just read, which I just went, okay, forget it. And I started it by saying, this isn't my story. It's Patricia and Terry's.
Right.
And just before the novel went to press, a last line occurred to me that seriously almost didn't make it in, but it just came like a bolt out of the blue, and I thought, this is either the cheesiest line ever, or it is just so perfect, and it's dynamite. So I called my agent at the time, and my editor, and ran it by my writer's group, and we ended up, and that really kind of brings the thing full circle. When I started the second novel, the one thing I was not going to do was write multiple points of view. Yeah, so the next one is in first person.
Okay.
And quite different.
With Breaking and Holding, though, for it, you know, it's so friendships and love and relationships are so central that it makes sense to have these different perspectives coming in. And for me, it didn't throw me at all. It's just like you'd read one chapter maybe with Lynn talking, and then you get over to, you know, Patricia and Terry's story, and like, oh, but I miss Lynn, but then you miss Patricia and Terry. So it really helped also keep the pace. But it was nice to get different perspectives in this very complicated.
Right, and really, it wasn't hard to write that way.
No.
They have very distinct voices, and I didn't have any problem slipping into or out of them.
You had to know your characters,
yeah,
though, in order to...
Yeah.
And when you started writing the novel way back when, did it start out as these multiple viewpoints?
Oh, that's a very good question. Uh-oh. No. In fact, when I started writing the original novel, there was no Lynn at all.
Really?
She was the major change, and... I'm going to thank my daughter for that one. We're very close. She's in her late 20s. And so she was reading this for me. You know, she was 23 or so when I wrote it. But so I gave her the first couple of chapters. And it was interesting. She had a very bad reaction to Terry. She said, Mom, I didn't even think he was one of the main characters. Are you kidding me? And It showed me, for one thing, how differently she and I viewed certain things today. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the an impetus for me keeping it in the 70s so that women could understand. And I thought, oh, now how am I going to do this? Because Terry is going to be kind of a jerk at the beginning.
Right.
I said, somehow I've got to have a way to show that even though that's going to happen and you're not going to like him very much, that this is going to turn out to be a really interesting and good relationship. So I came up with Lynn, just this person who has the whole perspective. And the more I worked with her, she became really, she's my favorite character. And I think most people who read it, she is also their favorite character. I've had that as feedback.
Right, right, absolutely. She really does become a central character in the book, even
mm-hmm.
though, like you said, she's sometimes a bystander.
Right.
Let's take a very quick break for station identification and a few announcements. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with Judy Fogarty about her debut novel, Breaking and Holding. And Judy, maybe we can talk a little bit more about Terry and flesh out his character a little bit.
WRUU brings you the most diverse and passionate local radio programming on the air in Savannah. This all-volunteer and nonprofit community radio station accepts no money from any form of government. Our diversity and independence is made possible only through the generous financial support of listeners like you. We rely on your annual and ongoing monthly contributions to cover the many costs associated with bringing you our broadcast and web programming. If you are a contributor, thank you. If you are not yet a contributor, please show your appreciation of the role WRUU plays in your life by becoming a contributor in any amount. You can donate quickly and easily by credit card or check. Just find the Donate and subscribe links at WRUU.org. Thanks for listening to and supporting WRUU.
Chatham Savannah Citizen Advocacy is a 36-year-old community-based nonprofit organization that recruits, matches, and offers support to over 110 local citizens in voluntary citizen advocacy relationships. Citizen advocacy is built on one-to-one, freely given, personal relationships between two people. One is a person with a developmental disability who has often been excluded from typical community life, and the other is a person who is living a good, ordinary life here in our community. For more information, contact SavannahCitizenAdvocacy.org.
WRUULP Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.
If you're just now joining us, this is Listening to Literature on WRUULP 107.5 FM. I'm your host, Lee Rich, and today we've been talking with Savannah author Judy Fogarty about her debut novel, Breaking and Holding. Now, Judy, we've talked about three of the four main characters so far. We really haven't talked too much about Terry. Who is Terry?
I so enjoyed writing Terry, and interestingly, he is a male, so writing from his perspective was a little different, but for me, he was actually the easiest one to write.
Really?
And a lot of fun to write. He is a tennis player. He's younger even than Patricia. He's almost 22, and he has his own struggles. He is severely dyslexic. And instead of getting a tutor for him when he was young, his mother, who was an overzealous sports mom and wanted him so badly to succeed, instead of a tutor, she got him a tennis coach. And she always pressured him, and his entire childhood and up to even to, where he is now at 21, his self-esteem and self-worth has been tied up in what happens on a tennis court. So he struggles with feeling like he's not smart and feeling like all he can do is play tennis, and he's got to succeed at tennis. And so he struggles too. And it's interesting, when he meets Patricia, they get started on a very bad way and situation, and they are so different. Readers have told me I had no idea how they could ever get together.
Right. Although, you know, but Patricia and Jack are so different as well,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's true.
Yeah, but, you know, Terry's also kind of struggling to find his voice and who he is. And like you said, it seems like the only character who at least seems confident and seems to know who he is Jack. Although, does Jack really know who he is? I'm not sure either, right? Now, Patricia... we talked about her a little bit earlier, how she loves literature, loves the arts, and that's where she sort of finds a sense of home. How did you go about choosing what Patricia reads? I mean, there are many references that you make all throughout the novel.
A lot of them are my favorites, starting with Gatsby, which is her favorite. Chekhov, I wanted her to have like a real passion for a writer, and so I chose Chekhov for that, whose stories and plays I also love. And I think you mentioned the seagull earlier. The way Chekhov and the seagull came to me, there was a scene early in the book where a seagull, because we're on the beach, flew into a sliding glass door and is lying dead on the beach. And the seagull kind of became a symbol for Terry and his struggles and path. And when they go to a play at the Dock Street Theater, which I dearly love, mm-hmm. in Charleston, and again, this is Terry trying to step into Patricia's world and her wanting to bring him into that, whereas he wants to bring her into sports, which she knows nothing about. But the play, then I thought, oh, my gosh, the seagull, of course.
Right, perfect fit.
Yeah, and you have some of those same themes, too, in there of people wanting to change and not finding the courage to change, and forbidden love and a triangle, and a tragic ending, which I think in ways I won't give away the ending, but
that's right.
but they do go through some very, very rocky times, and there is in chapter 11 there's pretty much a disaster. And I will mention too, back to Gatsby, if you read chapter 7 of Gatsby,
okay,
and look at the big confrontation between Tom and Daisy and Jay Gatsby, with of course Nick Carraway being there, and then go read chapter 11, which is a big climax of my novel, you'll definitely see me paying homage.
Oh, fabulous.
To Fitzgerald. And the other novel, the ones I chose for her all seem to relate to the characters in one way or another. Another important one was Peter Pan.
That's right.
Which she chooses that to give to Terry to read, which is quite kind of insulting to him. But she reads aloud to him as Wendy read to Peter. And I'll just tell anyone who hasn't read Peter Pan, it is so delightful and so humorous from an adult perspective. If you haven't read it, you really should pick it up. It's fun.
Right. And then early, I want to say it's in the first chapter, maybe the second chapter, where Lynn is talking to Jack about the changes that she's starting to see in Patricia. And she says to Jack, "You don't understand, Jack. She's reading Fear of Flying." And Jack says, "What? Why should I care about that? How does the Fear of Flying novel come into play so early in your novel?"
Yeah, that's another one you should pick up if you haven't read it. And I did pick it up for the second time as I began this novel. It was radical. It was published in 73. And it was the story. It was a big novel and the story of a woman doing it, not a man, a woman seeking to become the person she wants to be. And it was hailed by Updike and Henry Miller and everyone as a terrific novel. And the other thing that was very interesting is it's about a woman with a woman's sexuality. And she wants to have that same kind of attitude. Isadora Wing wants to have the same kind of attitude that a man has, which is enjoying sex for sex. So that would be very alarming to Jack if he knew that his sweet, dutiful wife right. were reading that. But when Lynn tells Jack she's reading Fear of Flying, his response is, "She's never been afraid to fly."
Right. You could really say that Jack doesn't get it.
Yeah,
right.
He doesn't get it and isn't aware of feminism, a woman's novel, the important films of the time, right. that An Unmarried Woman is a great one, which I also went back and watched. He has nothing to do with that.
Right.
He is just not aware at all. But yeah, it was a really radical novel and very highly regarded. And there's a phrase in there, two words, you know what they are. The first one I can say is zipless. The second one I can't.
Yeah, that's right.
I can't speak up here. But that really found its way into the popular lexicon. Everyone was using that term.
Right. And it really sort of catches the sense of the changes in women's rights and feminism during the 70s.
Absolutely.
And second wave feminism that started, you know, a little bit earlier. Do you think that Breaking and Holding is a feminist novel?
I do. The thing I love about the novel is you can read it on so many levels.
Right.
The one comment I get, if you go read the reviews on Amazon or Goodreads, the main comment I get is, "This is such a page-turner. There are so many things that happened that I didn't see coming, and I just had to keep going. I stayed up all night."
Yeah, that's what I did.
So I would say it's commercial. If you like a good commercial novel, read it.
It's you can enjoy it on just enjoying a nice read, yeah.
Yeah, a fun
mm-hmm.
read.
Yep.
But the writing, as we've talked about, is lyrical and rhythmic, and I would hopefully call it literary.
Yeah.
I think it's good prose. So there's that. There's the 70s. There's tennis. Tennis, you don't have to know anything about tennis at all to enjoy the novel.
Mm-hmm.
But tennis is like an extended metaphor throughout the novel.
Right.
And then you can just read it for as Gatsby meets Mad Men, or you can read it as a feminist novel, or just a fun look back at the 70s.
Absolutely.
So, but I do see if you were to ask me, like if you read the copy on the back, you have to have that protagonist thing. So it's Patricia Curran, such and such and such. But if you ask me, it's a story of two women.
Yeah, absolutely.
And their search for themselves and what they learn along the way.
Right, and finding their own voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're just now joining us, this is Listening to Literature on WRUU LP 107.5 FM. I'm your host, Lee Rich, and today we've been talking with Savannah author Judy Fogarty about her debut novel, Breaking and Holding. Now, Judy, you mentioned tennis, and like I said, tennis is an extended metaphor throughout Breaking and Holding, almost not quite a character in and of itself, but almost there. Now, I know you are an avid tennis fan. Where did that interest come about, and do you actually play tennis?
That's a question I get all the time. No, I've hardly held a tennis racket in my life, but I am head over heels, weak in the knees, in love with tennis. And it began, again, just on a lark. It was 1978, and my husband was in school in Athens. I was with him, of course, at University of Georgia, and they were hosting the NCAA championships. So just for something to do, we said, well, let's go to the final. The final happened to be a young guy playing for Stanford named John McEnroe.
Really?
And he played a very dynamic personality from NC State named John Sadry. And it turned out to be called The Match. It was 4 hours and 40 minutes long. At the end of the day, it was 143 points to 144. It was just an incredible match. And I really fell in love with the sport then. And I plan to take it up someday, but I really do love to watch it. And I just think it's a beautiful sport. And I also like it because it's an individual sport. And you always almost feel like you know the players. You know their game. You know their emotional makeup, who's going to react and lose temper, and who's going to never show anything and always be calm. So, yeah, I really love it and hope to play someday.
Oh, that's right. One of those things to put on the next to-do list.
Right.
And during the time period of the novel, now McEnroe is just in real life during that time period. He's just becoming a rising star. And he's what, about 19?
19, yes.
Yeah, so very, very young. But the one of the big matches you talk about in Breaking and, or your characters talk about in Breaking and Holding, is Connors Borg.
Oh, yes, because that was a big rivalry at the time. And that was too. Very different personalities. Borg was called the Ice Borg because he was so cool and collected. And Connors, of course, was one of the bad boys of tennis with his crazy antics and, you know, getting the crowd involved. But really, you can credit Connors and McEnroe and Nastasi for making it a more colorful game and really making it a sport that people became interested in as fans.
Absolutely. Let's talk about, I usually will ask this question of novelists toward the beginning of an interview, but I want to kind of hold this toward the end with you. Why the title Breaking and Holding? I sort of felt like we might needed to talk about the characters and the plot a little bit before we got to the title.
Right. Well, the title is refers to serve in tennis. You break serve or you hold serve. And there are so many things in the novel. The other, it refers to tennis, but it also refers to life, because we can be broken and we can find a way to hold on.
Right.
So it works in both those ways.
Right, and multiple levels. It's a metaphor for multiple levels.
Right.
Is Breaking and Holding in some ways a coming-of-age story? Would you phrase it that way, even though I know the characters are a little bit older than what we think of?
Right. Definitely. Patricia definitely comes of age, and Terry too, because he ends up going through a terrible time and has to regroup and deal with some family issues and come back and find himself. Patricia, of course, with her breakout into finding herself and going back and getting her degree and trying to self-actualize, really. So for both of them.
Right. And I definitely. Even saw it a little bit with Lynn in terms
right.
of trying to get out from under Jack's shadow.
Right.
Even though they respect one another and like one another, she's still kind of stuck within his shadow.
Yeah, and she admires him very much. As she gets to know him better over the course of the novel, some of that changes. But there's one point at which Jack really clarifies everything for her. He's like, you don't want to work with me. You want to be me.
Right.
And that's really very telling for her.
Right. Absolutely. It's kind of a wake-up call for her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so we have maybe about 4 or 5 minutes left. Let's talk briefly about your second novel, which you have finished. And that novel is called Moon.
Right.
And you said it's written from one perspective.
Absolutely.
Can you, I don't know if you're willing to tell us a little bit about the story of Moon?
I would love to tell you about the story of Moon. It is several interesting things for Savannians. It's set on the Isle of Hope,
okay,
where I live. It's a novel that questions the very nature of family.
Mm.
So that's very different. The main character, Darcy, Darcy Holland, is a classically trained singer. Mm. So you can imagine where that came from. She has a 4-year-old son named Zach, and he has just been an absolute joy to write. And my writing group, or a couple of other people who have read it, everyone just loves Zach. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's very interesting and I think will be very helpful about the novel is the ending. Darcy has to make a huge decision at the ending, mm-hmm, which questions family, the nature of family, and questions motherhood and what it means to be a good mother. So just say it's a yes or no decision, and you take my writers group, which is for women and me, and then you take, say, I have a few trusted readers who they read voraciously. They're very intelligent, and I would trust their opinion, too. So they've read it. And honestly, I have been amazed to find not only that people fall into two different camps, but they fall adamantly.
Really?
Into two different camps. So adamantly that I've listened to both and been torn, and I really have written two endings. And you may read it a year from now when it's published, hopefully, and I can't honestly tell you how it's going to end.
So you don't even know how your own book, even though it's written, you don't know how your own book ends.
Right. It will end one of two ways.
Okay.
And hopefully an agent or editor will have perspective. But it's just been remarkable to hear people react so very differently. And it's one way or the other.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
And is it set in modern times, in current times?
It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, for aspiring writers out there, people who are working through that novel they may have stuffed in their attic, you know, a long time ago, what advice do you have? What works for you with the writing process?
I would say, you really have to, it's an old adage, but you have to sit down butt in chair.
That's
and
right.
Write. And sometimes when I really don't want to do that, I will I just make myself sit down and I say, okay, let's see what we've got.
Okay.
And I put something down on the paper. And the other thing I would say to them is about doubt, because mm-hmm, I think beginning writers have doubts. I think experienced writers have doubts. I think people with a successful first novel have doubts about their second one. So I would say there's a poem by W.S. Merwin.
Who does come up in Breaking and Holding.
Oh, yeah. He's our favorite poet.
That's
I'd
right.
almost forgotten that. So Merwin has a poem called Berryman, when he was talking to the poet John Berryman, when and really questioned him because Berryman was older. And he asks a question at the end of the poem, which is basically, how can you know that anything you write is ever any good at all? To which Berryman answers, you can't. You can never know if anything is good at all. You die never knowing. If you have to be sure, don't write.
Interesting.
And I love that. I keep it on my bulletin board just because even when you doubt, you're just not going to know. So just write it and try it. And hopefully it'll be something that gets that other readers respond to, because that's really, I don't call it being about a success, but more about being read.
Right.
That's what I want. It's not money. It's not fame. It's not how many copies I've sold. It is just the pleasure of being read and having people respond to your work.
And connecting with others through the act, that creative act of writing.
Absolutely.
Right. That I think that gives a lot of writers out there a lot of hope, because when you're talking about, you know, even experienced writers have doubt, it makes me think of Jack in the novel, where Jack is probably the one character who, at least on the surface, comes across like he has no doubts about himself at all. And that's problematic, I think, mm-hmm. for him and for the people in his life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I would really like to thank you, Judy Fogarty, for joining Listening to Literature today, talking about your debut novel, Breaking and Holding, your second novel, Moon, hopefully maybe should be out in about a year, so we'll keep our eyes on that. And I want to thank all of our listeners for joining Listening to Literature today here on WRUU LP 107.5 FM. And if you would like more information about Judy Fogarty, you can check out WRUU.org or listeningtoliterature.com. Good day and good reading. The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. WRUU listeners like you crave exploration and discovery. That's how we can offer your business or organization a unique way to separate your name from the clutter inherent in commercial radio advertising. Underwriting on non-commercial WRUU will make your name stand out, because we only allow a limited number of sponsorships per hour. And your message will be reaching listeners who are actively engaged in programs that demand their attention. Let our team build a customized plan to meet your marketing goals by linking your name to our unique music and talk programs. For more information, email underwriting@wruu.org. The Savannah National Wildlife Refuge protects more than 29,000 acres of freshwater marshes, tidal rivers and creeks, and bottomland hardwoods along the Savannah River, supporting a diverse array of migratory and resident wildlife. Visitor activities include a scenic wildlife drive, biking and hiking trails, and a free series of monthly speakers covering conservation and historical topics on the second Saturday of each month. For more information, visit fws.gov/Savannah. This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.